My guest Roger Manley writes about and curates shows of visionary art, or as it's also called, outsider art. This is the work of artists outside the art world. Their art isn't intended for museums, but it usually transforms their personal surroundings, filling their homes, taking over their backyards, or covering their cars. Manley is the author of several books about outsider art, and he curated the current show at the American Visionary Art Museum in Baltimore. The show is called The End is Near: Visions of Apocalypse, Millennium, and Utopia. The first outsider artist Manley met was Annie Hooper. He had just started college and he was hitchhiking through North Carolina. The guy who picked him up asked if Manley wanted to come over and see his grandmother's wood carvings. Manley said yes, expecting to find duck decoys or ashtrays. Instead, he found the most amazing thing he'd ever seen.
I was expecting very normal kinds of things. It was just before Christmas. I thought I'd buy something for, you know, to give the family and that sort of stuff. But when we went in, as my eyes got adjusted to the light in there, I suddenly realized that there were thousands and thousands of faces looking back at me. You know, all these figures made of concrete and driftwood and spray-painted gold and silver and purple and Christmas tinsel dangling around the work. And there were artificial Christmas tree lights aimed at it. It's very strange. So I had to go back out there later on and take pictures. And something about those photographs that I took on the second visit out there started to, when I would show them to people, it would trigger things in their memories. They would say, oh, I know somebody like that. You know, I've got a neighbor who's building giant whirligigs out on his farm. That reminds me of my cousin who's collecting mule dung that looks like presidents of the United States and this kind of thing. And so I would, you know, start to go visit them and gradually realize that there was a phenomena here. This was some kind of thing going on where all these people were making this stuff out in these very unusual places. I mean, in the backs of service stations or in their apartments. They weren't in studios and they weren't in art departments. They were just out there in their tobacco barns and that kind of thing.
Tell me, in Annie Hooper's home with the thousands of sculptures, was there any room to walk or to sit, to prepare breakfast, you know, the kind of ordinary things one does at home?
She had clearings around certain things that she needed to get to. The place where her husband sat, there was a clearing around the television set. But throughout much of the house, there were just little pathways about 6 inches wide, and you had to place one foot in front of the other and kind of shuffle through to get from one area to another. I mean, you really need to sort of to see this to understand just how crowded it all was. It's a little hard for a lot of people to imagine without seeing a photograph of it.
Is she someone whose art you think connected in some way to a mental illness?
I think Annie's art came out of certain problems that she was having. Mental illness is such a weighted word these days. I mean, and it was even more weighted back then. I mean, and I can think of people in my grandmother's or mother's time period that just the mention that a cousin or something had a problem was always something you just didn't talk about. But I think in Annie's case, she grew up in a very large family, and that's something that I've noticed that some of these other artists doing. They're typically or often born into very large families. But she was surrounded by people most of her childhood. When I say large, she had something like 13 or 14 siblings, and then there were about a dozen foster children in the house at any one time, so that there were just lots and lots of people around. And she married into a huge family. Her husband was one of 9 brothers, and they all had big families. And then when the Second World War started, a lot of the males left. They were living on the Outer Banks. You have to remember, this is a string of islands off the coast of North Carolina. And a lot of the men left, and their wives went elsewhere to sort of last out the war. And Annie was suddenly left alone and didn't cope with it very well. Had what I guess you would call a nervous breakdown, and she went into an extreme depression. Her husband came and got her, came back. He had gone off to work in the Norfolk Naval Shipyards and then came back to get her and brought her up to the shipyards and said, you know, we'll rent a little house up here, and if you want to take in a few boarders to keep you company during the day, that's fine. So she took in 35 boarders and, you know, completely filled the house with people again. After the war, when they all left, I think she felt a sense of emptiness that just was overwhelming. And she began to deal with it by making these thousands of figures to take care of that sense of emptiness.
Could you give us a general description of what is meant by outsider art or visionary art or whatever term you prefer?
Well, it's art that is made by people who start off with some sort of inner compulsion to make something. They're not people who generally attend art school or learn to do their art through classes or studying books or anything like that. The kind of person who becomes this kind of artist tends to be someone who has had a career of one sort or another, and it's usually a career whatever they do for work. I mean, calling it a career sounds a little extreme sometimes, but it's a job that involves some kind of tangible evidence of their activity during the day. And what I mean by that is, like, a farmer could look back and see that he'd plowed so many fields, and a logger could see that he'd cut so many cords of wood, or a textile worker could see that she'd made so many towels, this kind of thing. And that at the end of the day, they can see the actual results of their labors. And then typically something happens, the death of a spouse or an industrial accident or an illness or early retirement, they're laid off. Something takes away that sense of self-value that they had. I mean, they came to value themselves over a period of years by the amount of stuff they could do. And then when that's taken away and they're left feeling idle and looking around and not feeling, that they're, I mean, they lose that sense of self-worth. And something in them, in a small percentage of people that this happens to, something in them triggers the need to make something else, to start making things again.
My guest is Roger Manley. He curated the current show at the American Visionary Art Museum in Baltimore. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Roger Manley. He's a folklorist and curator. He's curated several exhibitions for the American Visionary Art Museum in Baltimore, including their current show, The End is Near, which features art about the end of the millennium and visions of the future, visions of the apocalypse. He's also acting curator of the Gallery of Art and Design at North Carolina State University in Raleigh. The kind of art that you're dealing with, where people make these, you know, huge whirligigs in their backyard or cover their house in tile or do thousands of sculptures inside. This is an art that hangs tidily on the wall of a museum. What are some of the dilemmas you're faced with as a curator when you want to show some of this work?
Often I find myself acting as a liaison between the museum and the artists, and I have to work with the artists to make them understand that the museum is not making a huge profit off of their art or anything like that, that they'll get it back after the exhibition is over. Sometimes that's very funny. A while back, I curated a show for the North Carolina Museum of Art, and they were going to exhibit the work of an artist that lives nearby named Clyde Jones. Clyde was a former pulpwood logger, and after he had an injury, felled a tree on top of himself and was lamed for a while, began making all these thousands of chainsawed animals and setting them up in his yard. And we decided to borrow some of those for this exhibition. And I knew the day that they were planning to go down there and pick up his work, so I went down and stayed with Clyde and tried to keep him calm about the whole experience. So we were standing out there in the yard, and suddenly this climate-controlled truck from the museum drove up with the trained art handlers and their linen gloves, and Clyde was just agog at the whole thing. They carefully loaded each piece, wrapped it in bubble wrap, and padded it with styrofoam, and placed it in the truck with great care, just like you would handle something from the Parthenon or, you know, the Mona Lisa or something like that. And there was one piece that wouldn't quite fit toward the end, and they said, well, we'll come back tomorrow and pick up that piece. And Clyde said, oh, no, I'll save you the trouble. And he got out a chainsaw and cut it in half. And he said, just nail it back together when you get there. And that, so that was kind of an education for them. I mean, they had to, the museum people had to learn how to think about this work. You know, it's that, it's a different attitude toward art than a lot of trained artists have.
In addition to working with visionary art or outsider art, you also co-edited a book of photographs from Ripley's Believe It or Not. There's some great photographs in this book, including Joe Lorello, the man who could turn his head 360 degrees, and Lydia McPherson, who had the longest red hair in the world, and Singly, the fireproof Hindu, and the great Omi, the world's most heavily tattooed person, Joe Horowitz, who was billed as the man with the iron nose because he could balance an 18-pound saber on his nose, Leo Kongi, the painless wonder, I love this guy, who could drive 60 penny nails into his nose and stick hat pins into his body without discomfort, and he held his socks up with tacks driven into his legs. Do you see any connection between the art that you're dealing with and the very obsessive people who ended up in Ripley's?
A lot of outsider or visionary art is a way of calling attention to oneself and feeling special and feeling like you can do something, that, you know, feeling unique, like you can do something that no one else can do. And with the outsider or visionary artist, that comes out as art. For the people in the Ripley's collection, it comes out as a sort of performance or the discovery of some particular kind of talent, whether you can roll your tongue completely sideways one way or the other, or, you know, you can stand to stick your hand into a vat of molten lead or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, if you realize that you can do something that not too many people are willing to do, and that's attention getting, and it makes you feel special and that kind of thing.
I think too that that both of them are people who are absolutely obsessive about doing something that a lot of the outside world would think of as illogical or pointless. You know, whether it's holding your socks up with nails or building zillions of whirligigs in your backyard.
Yeah, but you know, I think these people, they're really important because how dull a world it would be if we were all just doing
like
the
you
same
and me.
Thing. Yeah, you know, getting up, going to work. Really, you know, I mean, when I think about peak moments in my childhood, I don't think about all the hours and hours I sat in classrooms or all the times that I went to church or whatever. I think about passing the self-kicking machine on the way to the beach or seeing the Watts Towers as I went to see my grandmother and that kind of thing. She lived in Los Angeles. And, you know, those are these kind of peak moments that stand out. And I think they do for a lot of people. I mean, I think people will far likely to recall every visit they ever had to a circus than they are to recall every classroom they ever sat in or, you know, every news program they saw.
You mentioned the self-kicking machine you used to pass as a boy.
Yeah.
What was that?
This was a machine that you stood at a crank, and it was just beside the road. There was no one around. There was no, you didn't have to pay admission or anything. It was just a machine. It just sat there next to the highway. And you would step up to it and turn a crank, and there was a series of four boots that were on a revolving wheel, and the wheel would kind of come up behind you and would kick you, and you know it was up to you to decide how many times you wanted to be kicked. It was a very strange thing, and it was part of the fun of it was the total irrationality of it. I mean, why would you want to stand and kick yourself? But it, you know, the fact that it was so unusual and seemed to serve no purpose other than just to exist and to give you something to think about was all its charm. I thought that was fabulous.
Well, Roger Manley, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Roger Manley is the acting curator of the Gallery of Art and Design at North Carolina State University. He curated the End is Near show, which will be at the American Visionary Art Museum in Baltimore through April 12th. His books include Self-Made Worlds, Visionary Folk Art Environments.